So first of all, welcome everybody. This is the second in a series of calls designed to help the homeopathic community become acquainted with some of the speakers for this upcoming National Center for, it's called the Joint Homeopathic Conference at the National Center of Homeopathy in Alexandria, Virginia. So this is really going to be a star-studded conference. It runs from April 8th through the 10th, and some of the speakers include people like George Vitolkis, Will Taylor, Annette Snivellet, Anna Vrivaka, Farouk Master, Massimo Mangiliavori, Alistair Gray, Miranda Castro. So this is really a very excellent speaker lineup and promises to be really one of the top seminars for the whole year. The conference will be running from April 8th through the 10th. That's a lovely time of the year to be in Alexandria, Virginia, which is right across the Potomac from Washington, D.C. It's cherry blossom season, so it's just a beautiful time to be in that part of the country. And there's a special for people who register before January 28th. You can actually choose a 20-hour recorded digital audio course on a number of different subjects. There's one on snake remedies, one on the homeopathic treatment of mental and emotional disorders, and one on new, old, and forgotten remedies. And actually, for people who sign up for all 3 days, there's an additional bonus of a two-hour class being taught, live webinar class being taught by Dr. Joe Kellerstein. So it's really quite a bonus if you sign up by the January 28th early bird special. Dr. Mangiliavori, have you joined us yet? Well, let me go ahead and introduce Dr. Mangiliavori, and hopefully he'll join us in the interim. Dr. Mangiliavori qualified as a medical doctor in 1984 and then specialized in food sciences at the University of Modena in Italy, where he received his diploma in 1987. His thesis was on the effects of fasting in human beings. He then went on to study medical anthropology from the beginning of his university career, and out of this grew an interest in traditional forms of medicine. This in turn led him to dedicate himself entirely to homeopathy, which he's been practicing since 1985. He attended some courses in Italy, but it was really only after meeting Dr. Giovanni Marotti of Maroma that he really became incredibly enthusiastic about the study and practice of homeopathy. Basically, Dr. Mangiliavori divides his time between practice and teaching seminars for a number of different organizations, including the Academia Medico Homeopathica de Barcelona, the academic departments of Glasgow Homeopathic Hospital, the Berlin Seminar of Homeopathy, Dragonfly Seminars, Four Winds Seminars, the Medical Society for Classical Homeopathy in Salzburg, the NEHA, which is the New England Homeopathic Association in Boston, and also the FHO, Foundation for Post-Academic Homeopathic Education. In 1993, Dr. Mangiliavori founded the Association for Homeopathic Research and Study called ULMUS, U-L-M-U-S. It's an organization that's active in teaching and research both nationally and internationally. Since 1994, he's organized various workshops and seminars for ULMUS, including an international seminar in Capri that is already in its seventh year. Dr. Mangiliavori has been a board member of the FIAMO, the Italian Federation for Homeopathic Association and Doctors, for the last 7 years. In 1993, in association with Dr. Giovanni Marotta, Dr. Mangiliavori initiated the first postgraduate seminars in homeopathy in Italy. Out of these seminars was born in 1998 the current International School for Continuing Postgraduate Training in Homeopathic Medicine, which is called CIMI-QUENA, which he runs along with Dr. Marotta. Dr. Mangiliavori has published a number of books, including Identifying with Society, Knowledge, Seduction, and Forsakenness, Silica-like and Magnesium-like, and the Sea Remedies. And so we're very very honored and pleased to have Dr. Mangiliavori, who's an internationally renowned homeopathic educator and practitioner, joining us today, hopefully. Dr. Mangiliavori, have you got in yet? Fantastic. Okay, so sorry for the technical difficulties, but everything seems to be in order now. Dr. Mangiliavori, thank you so much for joining us. and sorry again for the technical challenges. I've already introduced you, so actually we're pretty much ready to move forward. I did want to mention that Dr. Manju Lavori will be in Seattle in January teaching a seminar on McRepertory. What are the exact dates of that seminar?
The issue is not a seminar about the use of McRepertory, because this is a far too technical problem. It is that I'm insisting a lot on methodology, which
yeah.
I consider an important part of what we should do
yeah.
as teachers. And because I did a long work, more than 10 years, with David to develop certain specific features which I asked him to put into this program, in order to allow me to study and to work as I like, I would like to explain it to the colleagues which are interested to follow my approach, which kind of features I asked to put into this program. And I would like to explain some, let's say, little tricks for other colleagues which are interested to improve their use of this program, in order to follow more precisely their way of analyzing better cases, studying in terms of groups of remedies, considering a possible personal approach to homeopathic families, and things like that.
Oh, fantastic. Good. And then also you're going to be doing a seminar in Boston in May as well. And if people want to get more information about that, how would they do that?
Oh, this seminar in Boston is just one of the many which I'm giving since almost 13 years. I don't remember exactly, 12, 13 years. There is a school which is organized by the NEA, New England Academy of Homeopathy, and I'm teaching there since a long, long time ago. Now we're working on seminars concerning special kind of pathologies, from the homeopathic perspective, and I just gave the last September my experience about ADHD treated with homeopathy and a systemic approach involving the family members too for kids with this kind of problem. And the next seminar will be just a short introduction about my experiences in homeopathy with the remedies done from this gigantic kingdom of mushrooms. You know that in my approach, I'm working on this idea of homeopathic families since 20 years ago. But beyond this, I don't think at all that a biological family, one of the many classifications that we have about plants and other kingdoms, has always something to do with the homeopathic classification. Of course, this is according to my homeopathic experience. So I think that this gigantic kingdom of the mushrooms is something very interesting, because there are many, 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 many interesting substances. Old homeopaths like Allen himself did a very interesting work, which unfortunately, in my opinion, was never followed enough by other homeopaths. You know, we can study whatever we want now into homeopathic remedies. But this is, I think, a very unexplored dimension. So I'm not at all saying that I think that all the mushrooms can be so superficially related or shrinked into this box that we can call mushrooms. Let's say that some mushrooms, they really look like some others, and others, they look not at all like this. So this is not at all an introduction to a homeopathic family. It is my personal introduction to the work that I did since more than 15 years ago on those remedies. That's
great.
It.
Very interesting. So Dr. Manjivori, you're going to be one of the speakers at this year's upcoming National Center of Homeopathy Conference in April. And the topic of your talk is managing difficult cases, creating a successful practice. And
yes.
I'm curious, how do you face these? I mean, because this is a question that all of us as practitioners have all the time, is how do you specifically deal with these difficult cases where patients come in with, you know, using a lot of different drugs and other types of things that make it difficult to prescribe just straightforward, in a straightforward way? How do you personally deal with these type of challenges?
Okay. So let's say it is not so easy to answer so briefly. I think, again, this is a kind of not so explored field, or let me say that I think that this should be more a topic for good seminars and good congresses. Why I say this? First of all, I think that we do have on our background a huge experience of homeopathic cases from our old masters, let's say. But on one hand, the great majority of diseases treated by those colleagues were mainly, let's say, infectious diseases, not so commonly long-term follow-up cases like we do nowadays. I don't want to say anything bad, but, you know, even Hahnemann, he traveled so much in his life, and very seldom you can find out in old literature cases with the follow-up of several years. I mean, if you treat seriously, let's say, a neurological disease, a multiple sclerosis or something like that, it's useless to say that this is a good case with a follow-up of 5, 6, 7 years. You need much more than this. So my question is, how many colleagues in the world were able to collect and to publish good information on that? So I think this is a kind of new stuff, of new frontier of homeopathic treatment that we never had until now. Also because the kind of pharmacology which was used by the old master, the kind of allopathic approach of the old master, was very different from nowadays. It was also very different, the legal kind of problems, because they say that the time of Kant was not such a problem to take off a remedy for hypertension. And now in Italy or in many countries in Europe, if you do something like this, you go to jail. So in some other cases, if you have to treat a diabetes, if you have a treat to give a treatment to a case with the not working thyroid and many other things like that, you must face and interact with other doctors. So something is just to pile up one drug to another, one remedy to another, one herbalist product or different kind of therapies to another. Something else is to try to create a network with other good therapies that can help you in your work. This is an issue. Another important issue is how to organize a good research in this direction. Because, of course, I've spoken many times with other homeopathic doctors, which look to me a little bit of not orthodox but fundamentalist, and they say that if you are treating a patient homeopathically, you are not supposed to give anything else, which in many cases is not possible to be done because of many reasons: technical, legal, biological, ordinary problems, and many other issues. So I think that to be able to recognize what an homeopathic remedy is doing, to be able to recognize this together with other kind of treatment that for many other reasons cannot be avoided, is extremely important in order not to say we cannot treat this patient homeopathically because we are obliged to use other drugs together with homeopathy. And I think it's important for us to understand what we're doing and to understand what doesn't mean today to work in a network, trying to overcome our sense of omnipotence. That means that very often many homeopathic doctors, they believe that just with homeopathy you can do everything.
Dr. Mangivori, when you have patients who come in specifically with who are on a lot of allopathic medication, is there a specific posology approach that you use to address that, or how do you deal with that?
Again, I think it's pretty difficult to answer so precisely to such a generic question. It depends on the case, it depends on the situation. My experience in Italy, which probably, very probably is very different from your experience in USA, because in Europe and in different countries of Europe, the concept of medicalization, of medication, of using drugs, is pretty different from the States. Let me say that, for example, when I see cases in the United States, in Boston, in our supervision group, I can see children taking a huge quantity of drugs, which in Italy is very seldom happening, which in England is very seldom happening. So we start from different experiences. I can just tell you what I see in Italy. So it depends on the cases. In many cases, my experience is just reducing the huge amount of drugs which are just piled up. As I say, you can see an improvement without any homeopathic prescription, just being more rational in organizing a better allopathic treatment. On top of that, I think when you have a decent idea of how this remedy has to be done, this allopathic remedy, how they are really important, how they are really mandatory, I think a good stuff could be to start to reduce this, integrating with the homeopathic prescription. I never use more than one remedy in once, of course. And I think that after this, a good objective could be at least to reduce the side effect of the other drugs, to reduce the amount of other allopathic drugs, and to see which of those are really indispensable and which are not. Possibly, if it's a case which can go on only with homeopathy, I think that this is the optimum. This could be the best solution. But it's important to understand if this is what you want as a doctor, if this is what the patient wants as a patient, if it is really possible to be able to do something like this or not. So, and on which level we can say that we are satisfied by the reaction of this patient. But I repeat, I don't want to look too generical to you, but really I think every case is a single situation. I can have cases where I give a remedy once a day, where I give a remedy once a week, or where I give a remedy many times per day. It depends on which disease we're talking about, if it is a patient with cancer, if it is a patient with diabetes, if it is a patient with a neurological disease, if it is a kind of disease that can be just helped and overcome a certain state, or if it is a chronic disease that needs a medication daily. I think there are very, very different situations.
Dr. Mongevo, you had mentioned a moment ago about reading through the literature and looking at some of the old cases, and then you were talking about that in relationship to your own practice. Do you find that when you look at the old literature, that the way that the type of cases that we're presenting that homeopaths in the past used to treat are different from what contemporary homeopaths are treating? And how do you see the difference, and does that require a different approach in practice?
I think there are many differences. First of all, there is a cultural difference. I mean, think about what happened before the discovery of antibiotics. You know, to treat at that time an abscess successfully was a great prescription. And for that reason, you can see that in many books. You can find out suggestions for epar sulfur together with pyrogenium, together with, calibichromicum, together with the silica and other remedies that were considered useful, even grouped together, because they were good remedies for abscesses. Nowadays, you know, an abscess, for us, for the majority of us, is a kind of silly disease. It's something very simple. The idea itself of diseases is changed. I mean, the expectations of the great majority of doctors at the time of Kant compared to the experience of nowadays, to the expectation of doctors, to the expectation of patients, in many cases, is very different. Again, I think that saying homeopathy is just a word. The idea of homeopathy in India, in South America, in Brazil, in Italy, in States, can be very different. So first of all, beyond this word that, again, is very generic, we have to understand what does it mean, what is the request, what is the question of your patient, which are the expectation of our patients, which are the expectation of our doctors. Coming back to this seal example of the abscess, for us now, a patient with an abscess is not a serious case. You know that we can easily treat a patient like this. The worst could be to take an antibiotic or to send this patient to a good surgeon. You know, 100 years ago, it was very different. Nowadays, with an homeopathic prescription, very often, even too omnipotent, we can think that we have to improve his sexual life, his relational life, his concentration, his emotions, his performances, and many other things, which is not what which was expected by many of our colleagues many years ago. But because the model of what is a healthy person, because I repeat, the expectations are not the same. So we're working on a different model of medicine. And if this is not that explicit, how can we so easily compare our expectations with the expectation of the cases of 100 years ago? I think that it's not at all that easy to compare those experiences. It's important to know what those great masters did 100 years ago, 150 years ago. I think we can extract and try to understand their experience and to re-elaborate and to try to compare what is comparable and what is not comparable. This is what I think.
Interesting. Dr. Manjivore, I've heard you mention the word integrative medicine in the past, and I'm curious, well, could you, for all of us on the call today, could you kind of explain what is your concept of integrative medicine?
Good question. So, I think that very often, at least for my Italian experience, this is a wish more than a reality. This is something that very often is an interesting word pronounced by many doctors, but practically speaking, very seldom this is a real work in team. So if you send your patient to another kind of therapist, which can be, you know, Feldenkrais, osteopath, acupuncturist, psychotherapist, and so on, I think that a good integration is not just to send this guy there or to write a little letter and then have a telephone call. Is he doing right? Or thank you. Great. That's it. It's really to try to understand what another colleague is doing, what this colleague is seeing from his perspective, and to see how his perspective can be integrated, enriching your own, and how there can be a collaboration. I do believe that a team work means not only to pile up, to add one remedy, one prescription, one kind of therapy to another, but to try to see from different perspectives what can be seen in common, what could enrich each other, what can be used in order really to integrate what has to be done. I mean, if you break your leg, it's silly enough to pull a plaster and a good plaster on your leg. You can do a beautiful work using Symphytum. You say Symphytum, I don't remember in English how you pronounce it. You can do something much better doing a fantastic Feldenkrais or a good osteopathy. But, you know, these three works can be done by three different kind of specialists, or this work can be integrated, saying what did you saw, what I see, how this patient is reacting to this injury. You can think homeopathically about this from the perspective that there is a remedy about the broken bones, and that's it, which is very symptomatic. You can start to discuss how this specific person is reacting to this injury. What is the meaning of this injury? Why another patient in 7 days has a beautiful reaction? Why another case, which can be, you know, a case of arnica, a real constitutional arnica, could take months to recover from such an injury, which is the experience of the injury of this patient. And this is just a seal example. So if you give a look to this from a very organical perspective, an injury, it's an injury. It can be the same issue for a cow, for a lion, for a dog, for a man, for a cat. If you are investigating on how this patient is affected, really affected, superficially or deeply by this experience, this is another topic. And it has to be seen, I think, in a really network of other colleagues. And this is not at all an easy work. It has really to be built. It has really to be built in the direction of coping, collaborating, discussing, and finding out what is the best for different kind of perspectives and different kind of doctors. I hope it's clear what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Mojibor, you mentioned in the past this idea of a method of complexity in homeopathic medicine.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you specifically apply this in difficult cases?
Oh,
maybe a little, explain it a little bit and then explain it a little bit so that people can understand.
What does it mean, this approach of complexity?
Yeah. And then also, how do you actually apply it?
Okay. You know, not to make any publicity, I wrote a big book on that. So to show
you. You know what? This is fine. This is an opportunity for you to certainly let people know your seminar.
Yes.
Tell people.
Complexity, first of all, is not my idea. I mean, the idea of complexity is the idea of science of the last 20 years. Is a systemic approach where you consider that in a system, in a biological system, there are many different aspects that can be seen in a kind of integrative way, in a kind of dialogue between all those aspects, in a kind of really complex, articulated system, more than just limiting you to few observations in a very concise way. Is the idea that every system is a system, which means that it is interacting with many other things. That it is not that easy to treat a dog, a horse, a child, without considering what's going on in the family, which kind of food, which kind of experiences are moving around. So it's really the idea that instead of shrinking as the model of medicine is doing in the last years, why I say this, now we have an ultra-specialist kind of approach whenever you see a doctor. And we are, at the end, excluding, erasing the idea of complexity. Whenever you shrink your perspective, there is only something that you are watching, and this is what you are treating. The idea of complexity in homeopathy, I think, was always there, at least in words. The idea of thinking in terms of complexity is different, because often, even in the idea of repertorizing, if you want to be very simple, something is to put together in an additional way the symptoms of a case. Something else is to find out an organization, a dialectic, how those symptoms are combined in a coherence way together. This is one level of complexity. The second level of complexity is about our remedies, about the substances that we use for our remedies. Because, you know, there is, or there was, a good reason why Hahnemann decided to transform into homeopathic remedies many other drugs already used since decades or centuries before. If you open the books from the 15th, 16th century, you can see that many well-known homeopathic drugs like Nux Vomica, Aconitum, Sepia, and many others were already used. The great work of Hahnemann was to transform in the age of enlightenment this kind of, let's call, magical ideas into something more rational and more scientific for that time. But whenever you study those substances, you can see that in those substances there is always an organization of what we call the symptoms of those. There is always a coherency in what is coming out in terms of an homeopathic remedy. So this relation between how a substance does to be what it is, this coherence between this substance and the homeopathic remedies, this coherence between the homeopathic remedies and the way that every single patient, every single homeopathic remedies is organizing, is a strategy to survival, it's a different level of coherency, is a different level of similitude, how we call it in homeopathy, that can be seen, can be studied, can be applied. So something is done by a certain kind of plant to be what it is, to find out an equilibrium to survive. In terms of symptoms, you can see this into the proving of this substance. In terms of clinical experience, you can see how a patient, which can be treated by this plant, is really organizing his symptoms, his life strategy, in order to survive in the same way. So there is a kind of relationship between substances, homeopathic remedies, and patients, which is coherent too. And this is another more wide level of complexity. This is what I mean.
Interesting. And how do you use this concept in your practice exactly? Can you break in these difficult cases?
This can be used practically, considering that, for example, for ages we worked thinking, even teaching, that there was a big difference between Polycrest and small remedies. We discovered little by little that this is not true, that we do have remedies which are well studied and remedies which are not so well studied. And what is important is not to consider that there are remedies working better than others. I think it's important to understand that every remedy is a remedy, and it's important to find out what is really characteristic of every single substance, that potentially every substance is the same. So thinking in terms of complexity is also a way to find out which are, in my opinion, the relationship between those substances. From the homeopathic perspective, from the perspective of the substances itself, and from the perspective of the patients. I give you an example. Certain kind of substances are similar in their therapeutical action. This is the reason, for example, why we consider certain kind of vulnerable plants which are similar. This is the typical case of, arnica, millefolium, calendula, camomilla, bellis perennis. Many of those simple asteraceae, the ones which have this kind of flower which look like a sunflower, are very similar in their vulnerary effect, and they were used traditionally for this. It is interesting that with the homeopathic provings, we were able to demonstrate, homeopathically speaking, that they have some issue in common, some symptoms in common, and some concepts in common. Then when you see this in cases, you can see that it's not that easy to differentiate many times a good case of bellis perennis of the daisy from a good case of arnica, for example. So if you know this, if you know this kind of coherency, if you know this kind of resemblance, instead of just saying that Linnaeus decided to classify in the same botanical family the daisy with the flowers of arnica, you can consider that if you have good reason to prescribe arnica, you could have even good reason to think about bellis perennis if it doesn't work. But it's not that easy, because the way to classify plants has changed in the last hundreds of years. And the way that were used by Linnaeus was extremely simple, and it was only based on the appearance of flowers. The way that we can classify plants now can be at least 9 different kind of classification, and very often those classification has very little to do with what we see in homeopathy. This is the reason why, for example, in the case of those composite or asteraceae, you have other remedies like, the artichoke. You have other remedies like tenacetum and others, which have nothing to do, homeopathically speaking, with a good case of arnica or bellis perennis. But if you know the complexity of a substance, if you know the complexity of the proving, if you know that there are certain kind of resemblance, is less difficult, let me say, to think about a possible prescription of a so-called remedy which, because of the substance, because of the proving, resemble arnica, instead of thinking about any other remedy beyond arnica in your prescription, if arnica fails.
Right. Very interesting.
Is it clear what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And Dr. Mangiola, there are many homeopaths out there today who are prescribing using various taxonomical groupings. But you have a different approach where you actually talk about what are called like snake-like remedies. In other words, they're not part of the taxonomical grouping of Ophidia, but they have symptoms which remind you of the snakes. Could you tell us a little bit about this idea that you have in your practice?
Yes, I love it. So, of course, if you give a look to what we have in our literature, because the model of medicine, as I said before, changed so dramatically in the last 200 years, I think that when you say the family of ABC, it means nothing unless you define what doesn't mean this ABC. Okay? So let's say that for years, the main perspective was a very simple clinical ones. Remedies for otitis, remedies for injuries, remedies for a certain kind of scratching or things like that. Now, again, we are using a much more complex approach. I said before, our expectations from our treatments are very different. Expectations from patients and expectations from doctors. So, it's a human to try to shrink, to try to reduce, to try to simplify what we're studying. It's human because it's easier to do our best to find out shortcuts. It's more than understandable. On the other hand, we have to see if these shortcuts are useful for us or are useful for our patients, which is not always the same. So whenever we make a kind of classification, we have to recognize that those classifications can be extremely useful, and we have to face the limitation of those classification. So, as I said before, it can be very interesting to recognize that certain plants, that certain poison, you mentioned the snakes, can be similar. This is true. But, for example, if you consider the poison of some snakes, it's interesting to study those substances and to recognize, for example, that in the case of Crotalus and Crotalidae, there is a very different kind of reaction from the poison of some Elapidae. One of those is more hemotoxic, it works more on the blood. The other one, the Elapidae, works much more on the neurological system, on the nervous system. So even if there are two poison coming from snakes, the action of those two poison is not exactly that similar. Okay. So according to this, you can see, for example, that when you translate this into a homeopathic reading, many cases of Lachesis have very little to do with many good cases of Naya, or many good cases of Hydrophis chanocinctus, or many good cases of Elaps coralinus. It's so well known that the classical image of Lachesis is a very strong kind of personality, while the personality of Naja, in many cases, resembles much more a case of Silica, a kind of a very shy, timid, insecure, and reserved person. So I think it's important that we can recognize that something of those poisons can really produce similar symptoms, like the idea of being tight, like the idea of feeling that you are suffocating, and many common things like this. But on the other end, the profile of personality can be extremely different. So it could be interesting to say that probably the poison of snakes are similar from the homeopathic perspective. But this has to be proved, in my opinion, with good cases, with a decent long-term follow-up. On top of that, homeopathically speaking, you can prescribe an other remedy that can be, homeopathically speaking, again, similar to this, even if it's not a snake. So this is, I think, pretty important, because according to your own way of observing those cases, for example, good cases of Zincum phosphoricum, good cases of Melilotus alba or Melilotus officinalis can easily resemble, for many other reasons, a good case of Lachesis. So I think it's important to recognize this, because even if the substance has very little to do with the poison of a snake, even if this is a plant, it's not even the same kind of kingdom, you can see that there is resemblance, an homeopathic resemblance. So I think that it's important to recognize that nature can be classified in many different ways. There is not a single fixed box. This way has to be elicited, has to be explained. You have to say what doesn't mean that you mention family of, you know, Asteraceae, family of snakes, a family of whatever you want. And this has to be demonstrated. Otherwise, this is just an interesting hypothesis, but very often is very far away from what is the reality. And because, for example, mostly in the case of plants, plants can be classified according to at least 90 different kind of ways, why we have to use one of this way instead of another? Because of what? You can study plants according to flowers, to colors, to where they live, to which kind of alkaloids, to which kind of metals, to many other kind of things. And why do we have to use one of these classifications better than another one? At the end, I think that what is important for us is always to recognize this from a homeopathic perspective. To me, as a homeopath, I see this case, it looks like what? If I saw this case without knowing anything about this remedy seemed to be a good case of Lachesis, then I had a great reaction with another remedy. What does it mean? It is just my perspective, or this can be shared from the experience of other colleagues. This is what I mean.
Very interesting. Dr. Manjivora, as I'm sure you're well aware, you know, homeopathy has been taking some real hits in certain parts of the world, you know, like Great Britain and other parts of the planet as well right now. What are your thoughts on the current situation and the fact that homeopathy seems to be a decline in certain areas of our homeopathic community? What do you think is going on here?
Oh, this is a very interesting question. So, I think that we should try to divide what is the specific situation of United Kingdom, where there are many other interests about their health care system, about many money issues, about laws, about fights between hospitals, about association of doctors and lobbies and so on, where there are many more reasons to attack homeopathy. I don't think it's by chance that many of those attacks recently are coming only from United Kingdom and not from other parts of the world. It's not for nothing that this is happening. So this is a very specific issue of that country. That has to be contrasted, of course, but this is a specific issue of that country. On the other hand, I think that I'm astonished. I said this in many congresses I was invited. I think it's astonishing for me the situation we are facing in many countries. I can see this in the United States, I can see this in many countries in Europe, in the Western society mostly, where there is a serious decline. I had more than once interesting speeches with a person that I cannot tell you the name, the telephone now, from important companies of homeopathic products. And those people, since years ago, they can see that for them it's much better to try to invest in the idea of selling homeopathic remedies to the malls, where people can get those without the prescription of an homeopath, instead of moving, seeking for homeopaths, because there is a progressive, serious disinterest, lack of interest about homeopathy, and we have to ask ourselves why. I remember when I was a student, the average age in seminars was around 25-30. Now the average age in Europe is 45-50. And we have to think about this. Why students of medicine, why young people is not so much interested in homeopathy as it was before? You know, a kind of decline can be physiological. Let's say that something like this probably happened to acupuncture 20 years ago. And then after a kind of boom, there was a decline and then a kind of stable situation. But what I can see in homeopathy now, it's really worrying me. I'm seriously worried for that. And I think that this is interesting because it is happening something which never happened in our history until now. Because on one end, the request from patients about what more or less is considered homeopathy, because very often they use this word without knowing what does it mean, is growing in some way. And I can see that in many countries in Europe, there is even a better idea of what is a classical prescription, which means going to a good serious homeopath, which is prescribing one remedy, versus others which are prescribing, you know, whatever you want altogether. But despite this, the number of homeopaths is declining. Very few people can survive with this profession, just working as homeopaths. Very few people can endure and support themselves. They can get their bread and butter every day just working like this. And this is interesting, considering that in the last 20 years there was really a great revolution in this medicine. I think that we know much more than years ago. We have programs that can allow ourselves to be more precise in studying and prescribing. Years ago, doctors can only work with the remedies in their own office. Now you can prescribe whatever you want. So practically speaking, there is availability to our world of prescription and remedies which never existed. And on the other hand, there is a lack of interest. I think that there is not just one answer to this gigantic question. I think there are many reasons for that. An important reason, I think, that in my opinion, homeopathy in the last years was very closed, not so open to talk with other fields of science, was not so open to interact with many other fields of science around homeopathy, or let's say it happened only in few cases. There was a kind of a very selfish, auto-referent attitude of the international homeopathic community, thinking that we were the only one having a kind of natural and systemic approach to health, which is in many, many ways absolutely old. Old in the sense of being obsolete. I think that something extremely important is to be attached to our roots and to recognize the genius of homeopath, the beautiful things that was done since 200 years ago. Something else is to confound our roots with the kind of integralism and fundamentalism that looks more a religious approach than a scientific one. And because probably, let's say, a little bit exaggerating this concept, our community was more religious than scientific in the real sense of the word, probably this was a good reason why we are lacking interest in this direction, in my opinion.
Interesting. Dr. Majibur, I'd like to open up the lines and let some other people ask a few questions. Before I do that, though, I just want to mention again that Dr. Majibur will be one of a number of top-level speakers at this year's upcoming joint conference in Alexandria, Virginia. If people want more information about the conference, they can go to the National Center of Homeopathy website, which is www.homeopathic, that's H-O-M-E-O-P-A-T-H-I-C, homeopathic.org. If you go to the very home page there, if you look on the left-hand side, you'll see the link for the conference page. And right now, there's an offer. They're offering a special for people who sign up, register before January 28th, where they can actually choose a free 20-hour recorded digital audio course on one of three different subjects. There's one on snake remedies, one on new, old, and forgotten remedies, and one on the homeopathic treatment of mental and emotional disorders. And actually, for those people who sign up for all 3 days, they get an additional bonus of a free a two-hour webinar class with Dr. Joe Kellerstein on the homeopathic treatment of some interesting cases. So this is quite an incentive for those who are interested in participating in this top-level conference and are ready to register before the January 28th early bird special deadline. Dr. Majibur, before I open up to the lines, could you just quickly tell us what could people hope to how could they benefit in their own study and practice of homeopathy by attending your three-hour presentation at the conference?
Oh.
Presentation
is a presentation. I think that I like this idea of talking about those interaction between homeopathy and other kind of treatments, because I think it's very real. It's what we do in our daily practice. I hope it can be interesting, even if I'm presenting my experience from Italy, which I repeat, I think is pretty different from yours, because it's another perspective from a doctor which is mainly treating very difficult cases. This is what I do in my work. 80% of my cases are serious clinical situation. So it's a very practical experience of managing practical situations like this. I think it can be useful for that.
Fantastic. Well, I'm sure everyone, we're all very excited to...
It's a very experiential and practical approach, very down to ground.
Fantastic. Sounds great. Let me open up the lines and let some other people ask some questions. So are anybody on the line who would like to have a question for Dr. Mangiovori? Don't be shy. I know there's a lot of people on the line. Can people hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Questions for Dr. Mangiovori?
I have a question.
Please, go ahead. What's your name first?
Donna.
Donna, go ahead.
I heard you speak many years ago at one of the national conferences, and it was about using lower potencies, and I just wondered if you could take a moment to tell us whether you're still using the lower potencies in your practice as much as you were back then.
Oh, la, la. I can tell you what I do. I am not that sure that I said that I use lower potency. I mean that my main experience since more than 17 years ago is to work with the Q potencies. The Q potencies are the preparation which Hahnemann used in the last 20 years of his life, which is a little bit different from LM. You know that the sixth edition of Organon was published more or less 80 years ago, and before this book came out, it was known that Hahnemann diluted remedies in a different way, but it was not known exactly what he did. Let's say that the main difference between an LM and a Q is that LM are done using matter tinctures, and those matter tinctures are done again differently in France or in Germany, because in one case you just leave the substance in alcohol, in the other case you use the juice of the substance, in the case of the German pharmacology, while in the case of the Q potency you use the entire substance. What does it mean? That if you use, for example, Aurum Metallicum, LM1 or Q1, it is more or less the same. If you use, again, Arnica, Q1 is different from Arnica LM1, because in the case of Arnica Q1, you use the entire plant and not just mother tincture. I hope it's clear what I mean. So, according to what Hahnemann wrote, he wrote that in every case, he always started with the Q1, even more than once a day, until he saw a reaction, and then he stopped, and then he considered how to repeat this dose again. So I was interested in his experience, because in Italy at that time we had only, let me say, because I want to be diplomatic, not so good remedies, and I was interested to taste, to try those remedies in Q potencies. I had great results, much better than what I could see with my poor homeopathic remedy in Italy. So I'm not saying at all that those poor remedies are the same all over the world. Of course, you have beautiful pharmacy in the United States. And so I started to make experiences with this. So what I do since that time is that more or less in 95% of my cases, I work with Q potencies or with LM when I cannot find out a Q. And I always start from the number one. And then, little by little, I rise the prescription, moving to upper dilution if I think that this is the right remedy.
Very interesting. I think we have time for just one for Dr. Mangiovori.
Which translation of Organon are you using? German-Italian translation or German-English translation?
I don't understand your question, sorry.
The question was, which translation of the Organon are you using? Is there an Italian translation, or are you reading for an English translation, or which translation of the Organon?
I use a different kind of this. I prefer to work with the English translation, with the very last one, which was done recently. I am not so good in reading German.
So you do the English translation or Italian, is that what you said?
The English.
The Wendell Brewster O'Reilly annotated version of the Stephen Decker translation, is that the one?
Exactly. Okay,
fantastic. Well, I think we're out of time. Dr. Mangiavori, thank you again so much for joining us. We know you've got a very full practice and busy travel schedule, so we very much appreciate it, and we're looking forward to having you here in the United States to learn from. I'm going to open up the lines.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.